Well, in a weekend when the radical jihad went crazy across the globe, we also had to deal with Hillary Clinton getting interviewed, and I've got a little bit on that. Speaking of interviews, though, I've got an interview with Steve Pierce that I did last Friday, and I didn't know how many people would be listening yesterday with all the 4th of July stuff, so I decided to go ahead and put this interview on for today. And it was good. It was interesting. But anyway, one of the things that you can't help but note is all the bombing that went off in the last week or two. There were bombs. Some Muslim kid, I think 19 years old, something like that, in Tucson, had a strategy. He was going to blow up some federal buildings, I guess, supposedly. And then you've got Bangladesh. You've also got the attack in Baghdad. And we're talking of hundreds and hundreds of people dead and other places. So one of the interesting things is there was an attack within the state of Saudi Arabia, which is unusual, or at least we don't hear about it a lot. And so they blew up some bombs in, I think, Medina, where close to where there were some, you know, foreigners and such. And I think they blew up some Saudi guards, security guards or police. So anyway, let me just kind of fill you in very quickly on the Hillary Clinton situation. I have no idea if she's going to get indicted. I can't imagine that this president would be out traveling with her if he was going to be allowed, if he was going to allow her to be indicted. And on the other hand, and CNN has said that news is coming out that she's not going to be indicted. And then I read a editorial on that that just says nobody really knows what happened in the interview. And then Frank Lutz, the pollster for the GOP or for the conservative side, said she has to get indicted because, you know, basically what she did is less than Petraeus. But anyway, here's a little bit on her interview.
Hey, Fox News Alert, as we continue to cover the breaking news out of Washington, Hillary Clinton, the presumptive Democratic nominee.
The dreaded spin. Well, from what I understand, it lasted for hours. She was interviewed by eight people, I should say. It could probably men and women. And that's really all we know. I mean, now what I want to know is that was the meeting between Bill Clinton and Lynch, did that kind of spur this interview? Don't really know. But let's get to, let me get this interview with Steve Pierce for you right now. It's a little bit hot outside right now for the early morning. It was pretty toasty yesterday, I think 104 degrees right now, and the possibility they were saying yesterday anyway of some rain. So here is the interview with Steve Pierce that I did this last Friday. Well, folks, this is a special segment with Steve Pierce here. He gave us a little bit of time. He let me know ahead of time that we'd have a chance to meet and come together on the studio to chat. And today's the first day of July, and it's great to see you, Steve.
Nice to be here. We're in Las Cruces for the Electric Light Parade a couple of days from now. Going to be working up and down the valley here for the next day, out to a ranch tomorrow, driving school this afternoon. We just spent time with the Forest Service and ranchers up on that constitutional issue about their water rights up on the mountain yesterday. So a very active time for us, but we'll be in the Electric Light Parade on Sunday night.
So are you going for your CDL?
Yeah, actually trying to get that. Figure I'll just drive a truck around the world next.
That would be great to have a mobile office.
Absolutely. We have one of our former staffers That's what he did for the Forest Service. And so I've always thought about just taking that thing and moving around, big 18-wheeler semi with the, all the comforts and printing machines, copiers, whatever you need inside.
Or as a late great country star sang, big wheels keep on moving.
Big wheels keep on moving. That we do. We've made a lot of hours on the road already. We've come from the northern end of the district, actually slid up north of Santa Fe, had some tribal meetings on Indian housing. I'm taking the nation lead on that, and people are asking me to come and visit with them about their situation. So we've been very active this 4th of July break.
All right, so let me ask you this. As coming into the 4th of July, and I know you're a patriot, and I know that you and I have talked many times about the history of the country, natural law, the Constitution, and all these things. What's on your mind this July the 4th, 2016?
I'm looking at the world situation. You know, the vote in England took everybody by surprise. For me, I think it's a manifestation that people are saying, give us our independence back. We don't want to be a part of anything global where somebody in a different country is making decisions for us. I think it's also a response to that big centralized system saying that you're all going to open your borders up and let people in, forget if they're going to take the jobs, take the benefits. That's not your problem. You don't worry about it. And people are saying, we're worried about it. So that was a really stunning thing. And then, of course, the development of the election here with Donald Trump just summarily working through a field of 16 candidates who are actually.
We've got a phone call here, and could be we're not on the air. This is Kelly.
Kelly, it's Ralph. I was just calling you to let you know you were up here.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so anyway, I have been playing an interview with Steve Pearson. It's coming over my radio inside the studio, but I'll have to figure out what's going on with that. Anyway, we'll switch gears here. There is it's actually about a 25-minute interview with Steve Pearson, and it was playing fine here, but I'm not a super tech person, so I might have to get some help with that, but in any event, all right, so let's move over here. Let's take a little break. This is from one of the greatest jazz albums called Song for My Father, Horace Silver. Kelly O'Connell, it is 6:14. Today is the 5th of July, the day after. Had a good show yesterday. For those who are listening in, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOVE. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 and 805-6180. We'll be right back. And by the way, you can't help but notice the resemblance of this to Steely Dan's song, Ricky, Don't Lose That Number. All right, so we've got this, I do have this little clip of what happened in the interview with Hillary. Now, interestingly, one of the things that has come out during these interviews is that Hillary took her daily schedules and burned them. Why she did that, I have no idea, but here is on that.
Hey, Fox News alerted.
And by the way, this is on the aftermath. This is the clip I tried to play for you earlier.
As we continue to cover the breaking news out of Washington, Hillary Clinton, the presumptive Democratic nominee, meeting with the FBI for 3.5 hours today at FBI headquarters, at issue her private email server that we now know had significant amounts of classified information on it. The campaign putting out a statement saying she, meaning Secretary Clinton, is pleased to have the opportunity to assist the Department of Justice in bringing this review to a conclusion, end quote. We now know from the FBI director, among others, that the FBI does not conduct security reviews. They conduct criminal investigations. One of the first people to make that point on television, former FBI Assistant Director Steve Pomerantz, who joins us now in studio. Steve, nice to see you. Thankfully, neither of us have ever had an FBI investigation, interrogation, or interview. Give us a sense, and probably most of our viewers haven't either, give us a sense of what it's like at FBI headquarters at 8 a.m. this morning when Hillary Clinton walks in the door.
Okay, I think the first thing to remember is this is not a picnic. This is an adversarial process. She is the main subject, we believe, with good reason, of a criminal investigation. You're exactly right. They can call it whatever they will. It's a criminal investigation. She is the main subject of that investigation. And this interview, interrogation, if you will, is the culmination of that lengthy investigation. They, the agents who are going to conduct this interview, have prepared for weeks, if not months, and have a list of questions very long to ask her. It's an adversarial process. They're looking for information. They're looking for the truth, and they're looking to get the questions answered that they have. So this is what's going on at FBI headquarters and has gone on for 3.5 hours. It's a difficult process, and these agents, excuse the terminology, but they want to sweat her. They want to get her under pressure, and they want to get answers to tough questions that they have. This is not a pleasant process for her.
A, can you answer this question? Did she have to be in the room? Did she have to talk to federal agents today? And B, what type of representation is there with her? Meaning, you know, so often when we look at, and this is apples to oranges, when we see her up on the Hill and she has a panel of lawmakers, so she's getting hit with all sides. Is there a panel of FBI agents? What type of environment is
there? Yeah, that, of course, I can't know right. on this in this case. In a normal criminal investigation, which this is anything but, I realize, you would have one agent, probably two.
Good cop, bad cop.
Well, sometimes helping each other remember what questions they want to sequence, taking notes. It's always better to have two. In an ideal situation, there would be an ideal situation from an FBI agent's perspective. There'd be no lawyers in the room. Certainly, they don't need help, in my opinion, from government lawyers, although sometimes the Justice Department has a different opinion, and they put somebody in the room. They certainly don't want her attorney in the room.
And she didn't have to be there.
You're right. I need to answer your questions directly. A, she did not have to be there. Nobody has to be unless they're arrested in the company of the FBI. So she's there. I've heard the expression lawyering 101. What every second-day lawyer will tell any criminal defendant is don't talk to the cops. You don't have to do it. Don't do it. She's there, and I'm sure if she was not running for office and was going to retire and raise her grandchildren – she wouldn't be there, but
well,
she has
that
to be.
We've seen that
she
from
has
the Clintons.
To be from a political perspective.
We've seen that from the Clintons
there.
Before, though. She didn't talk to the State Department Inspector General.
Exactly.
Big key point that the Clinton
exactly.
folks have overlooked. And we look back at other investigations into the Clintons. They lawyered up
exactly.
as much as they possibly could and obstructed as much
yeah.
as they could. So to your point, really, this was a political decision in terms
be.
Of sticking
Correct.
In terms of being in that room.
Correct.
We know about the email server. We don't know how many of the deleted emails that the FBI has recovered. But conceivably, the FBI agents know what's in their cars.
Oh, yeah.
Hillary Clinton may not
That's
know.
Correct.
And that comes in the issue of if you're going to meet with the FBI, you've got to
tell
the truth.
Tell the truth. The worst thing that she can do from her own perspective and from her attorney's perspective is to lie to them. That's the worst thing. We've talked about other cases where people have gone to jail, not for the underlying offenses that were under investigation necessarily, but because of the way they conducted themselves during the investigation, either obstructing, witness tampering, or lying. So that you're right. And she does not know. She may think she knows, but I assure you she does not know the totality, nor does her lawyer know the totality of the information that the FBI agents have now in terms of the months-long investigation they've done.
Wait.
This is not a pleasant experience for her. Has not been, I assure you.
Well, Steve, we know you were on the other side of a number of those investigations. We appreciate you being here with us. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
All right, so that was, I guess, as much as we're going to know from that. The thing is developing. They've got to do some things. They've got to try to get this thing finished before the election, it would be my thinking now. I know we've talked about this before, and it's been in the media quite a bit. What would happen if Hillary got indicted before the election? Would she have to drop out? She wouldn't have to drop out. And they could go after, I guess, with for some minor thing, a misdemeanor or whatever. But I would think that if she got indicted, there would be enormous pressure on her to leave the campaign. I mean, right? How does she not get that put on her? So I've got something very interesting for you that I ran into over the weekend. I've never really paid that much attention to the Clinton Foundation, to be totally honest. I listened to an interview last night that just absolutely floored me, and I wanted to share it with you. And I was planning on playing this thing with Steve, but since that's not working out, why don't we get into this Clinton thing? Clinton Foundation is, I couldn't believe the stuff that this guy was an investigative reporter, and he says he's been working for months and years on trying to trace the Clinton Foundation. And he made it sound like it was, there were somehow billions of dollars involved, and that the Clinton's involvement in Haiti and Africa and all these places was fraudulent. I couldn't follow some of it because, you know, it's obviously a very kind of wide and sweeping statement, but there's a lot of people out there that are now talking about the Clinton Foundation. And here is a little bit on the Department of Justice seeking a 27th. Well, this is 27 month delay in Clinton Foundation email release. And this is from about a week ago from Fox.
Are there more Clinton emails you might not see, at least for a while, like way after the November election? Because the DOJ filed a motion seeking a 27-month delay in releasing Clinton Foundation emails. Now, those emails are correspondence among Secretary Clinton's top four aides at the State Department, Clinton Foundation officials, and a public relations firm that President Bill Clinton helped launch. Now, if this motion succeeds, we would be 22 months into a hypothetical Hillary Clinton presidency before we'd see even one of those emails. Chairman of the American Conservative Union, Matt Schlapp, goes on the record. Nice to see you, Matt.
Great to see you, Greta.
And during the break, I did verify Colonel West is right, is that to the extent that it's of significance is that Bill Clinton appointed Loretta Lynch, U.S. Attorney in the Eastern District of New York back in 1999. But anyway, turning to this, what do you think about the fact that DOJ, 2 days after this meeting on the tarmac, is now going to court saying we need 27 months to produce these emails?
You know, Greta, you almost can't make this up. I don't know whether everybody involved in this investigation and with Secretary Clinton's core team is guilty, or they just want to do everything possible to make it look like they're guilty. First of all, we have to find out about a server. We can't get a hold of emails. Now we know that there are emails, and we even know the number of emails, but they think for budget reasons it's going to take 22 months to read them and make them public so they can be compliant with the law. That's just crazy and absurd.
Well, they're saying they're not trying to hide anything, that it is,
right,
as you say, budget, you know, that they can't produce them. But the problem is that why didn't they ask for more money, or why,
right,
didn't they at least notify us earlier? I mean, if you at least sort of give a hint that you have this problem, people are a little bit more sympathetic and less inclined to be suspicious. And, of course, now just coming 2 days after this meeting on the plane, there'll be some people that think that this is a quid pro quo. I mean, there's something discussed on Monday about the emails.
Yeah, and I think the budget response is not the right response.
All right, so let's get into, I mean, I was absolutely floored when I was listening to this guy that was getting interviewed, which I'll play for you in a minute. We'll take a break and I'll play it for you. My ads are all screwed up today, so I'm not, I guess over the weekend something happened with a computer, but anyway. I'm going to play just a little bit from CNN, CNN Money, on why the Clinton Foundation is so controversial. But I'm going to get into this interview for you on this guy that did this investigation. I was sitting there with my mouth hanging open listening to this. But anyway, Here's from CNN.
Aims to fix the world's big problems, but has caused serious ones for Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail.
The Clintons with the foundation, it's a disgusting situation.
Do I have a problem when a sitting Secretary of State and a foundation run by her husband collects many millions of dollars from foreign governments? Do I have a problem with that? Yeah, I do.
During her 4 years as Secretary of State, donors poured more than $476 million into the Clinton Foundation.
The temptation for that to become a vehicle for influence peddling is enormous.
Conservative author Peter Schweitzer argues some foundation backers received favorable treatment while she was the nation's top diplomat, but there's no proof.
I don't have an email or a taped conversation where somebody says, if you do this, we will give you that. I would say that is a ridiculous standard.
You kind of need a smoking gun if you're going to accuse someone of illegal activity, no?
I don't accuse them of illegal activity. What I say in the book very clearly is there's a troubling pattern of behavior, and this demands investigation by people that have subpoena power.
The Clinton campaign rejects Schweitzer as a Republican operative. But back in 2009, these issues surfaced before Hillary became Secretary of State.
The Clinton Foundation exists as a temptation for any foreign entity or government that believes it could curry favor through a donation.
That's why President Obama required the foundation to publicly release its funding sources and flag any foreign donations for State Department review. But that didn't happen on at least one occasion.
Were there, you know, one or two instances that slipped through the cracks? Yes, but was the overwhelming amount of anything that anybody gave the foundation disclosed? Absolutely.
It failed to disclose a $500,000 donation from Algeria for Haitian earthquake relief and millions from a Canadian partnership. Other mistakes include not reporting as much as $26 million from foreign governments and corporations for speeches the Clintons gave. And it had to refile several years of tax returns after combining government grants with other donations. The foundation acknowledged and fixed all of the mistakes and enjoys a top rating from charity watchdogs GuideStar and Charity Watch. After Hillary announced a bid for the White House, the foundation took additional measures to allay concerns about transparency. The foundation restricted the number of countries it would take donations from to only six, and it started disclosing donors quarterly. But even some supporters say that's not enough.
I think it would be important for her to make clear right now that if she's president, that the foundation will not take money from any foreign interests and will not take money from anybody, whether it's an individual or a company, that does business with the United States government or plans to do business with the United States government.
Does that make them viable to operate as a foundation anymore?
The answer is it might not make the foundation viable, but if you want to be president of the United States, there are just certain things that your family cannot do. That's the price of seeking the presidency.
Christina Alessi, CNN, New York.
All right. So in this interview with this investigator, who I'd never heard of, but he was an older guy, he said that there was $600 million donation or $600 million in donations that he traced to Switzerland. And that was kind of surprising. And then he said that only 10% of the money that was given to the Clinton Foundation was spent on charitable activities and the rest go for staff and such. So he was saying that Bill Clinton basically flew around the world on this thing. Well, let's take and just lived high on the hog, and he just made it sound, I mean, it was just totally amazing that I hadn't heard it or I hadn't paid any attention to it since he's out of office. But I think it's going to come back and haunt Hillary. It already is, actually. Here's a little bit more. Horace Silver, we'll take a break. 6:34, I have your weather for you. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 and 805-6180. We're looking into the Clinton Foundation. All right, so I've got this interview with this guy that is, this is on One America News Network, which I'm just vaguely aware of before this, but this is where I heard a lot of this stuff from. And so check this out, and looking for this guy's name. Well, I'm sure they'll announce his name, but this is the one that really opened my eyes last night.
Our next guest is a known whistleblower, a financial analyst who's exposed some of the largest corporations in our nation for financial discrepancies, and that's putting it nicely. This man was responsible for exposing General Electric, AIG, and now he's aiming higher, alleging a bombshell analysis, charity fraud, he describes it, at the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. Take a look.
Everywhere in the world where there is real progress, you find creative networks of cooperation. The non-governmental organization is the instrument through which people of goodwill and passion can change the course of the future. And you cannot refuse to do anything just because you can't do everything.
We're all citizens of this world. Let's build a better future together.
Joining me now is Wall Street analyst Charles Ortel. Charles, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Liz. Appreciate it.
All right, sir. This is not the first time that you've uncovered financial discrepancies. You had General Electric. You had AIG. Now you say you found some cash flow discrepancies with the Clinton Foundation. Tell us, what did you find?
Well, all public charities, and that's what the Clinton Foundation started out as being. It started out being simply a library and archive based in Little Rock, and that was its sole tax-exempt purpose. All public charities whose revenues exceed a certain number, it depends state by state, have to provide each year an independent certified set of financial statements that is called a professional audit. The Clinton Foundation, since inception on October 23, 1997, has tendered into the public domain documents that purport to be audits, but they're not audits. They're not compliant with the actual tough regulations that exist in places like your state, California, my state, New York, and around the world. And when you start pulling beneath the surface and looking at the actual financial statements and cross-checking them, these financial statements can readily be cross-checked. There shouldn't be discrepancies. They can be cross-checked for the foundation alone, and they can be cross-checked for their disclosures against the disclosures of charities that say they gave amounts to the Clinton Foundation. For the last 15 months, I've been doing that type of painstaking work, and the discrepancies in the numbers that we see run in the many hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay, well, let me ask you this first before we even get into the nitty-gritty of the independent audits and what laws they might be breaking there. How do you know? You say you've been analyzing this for 15 months. What kind of access to records do you have, and what records are you looking at to determine this?
All right, well, that's a good question. So the starting place for the Clinton Foundation, for the people who don't know better, is to look at their own website. And there they put up information, financial reports that go back to 1998, but audits that start in 2004. So in the beginning, there's a bunch of missing information. The versions that they put up on their website are very different, materially different from the versions that you can find by looking in the states where they have operated inside the United States and outside the United States in online databases that are freely accessible. The second thing you can cross-check are press releases issued by the Clinton Foundation and others at the time that these major donations and grants are made. The third thing you can check, which I've checked, are after-action audit reports. The big governments that give money away have had troubles. So, for example, the government of Norway, the government of Australia, the government of Canada, the government of Ireland, the government of the UK, each of these organizations and multilateral organizations will do special reports on a country, the progress in a country, and they contain extensive reports that don't foot. But the biggest place to start is with the largest donor, and the largest donor to the Clinton Foundation is a name very few people know. It's called Unitaid. Out of the $2 billion in declared contributions, which may or may not, and most likely are not the total amount of money sent towards the Clinton Foundation, of that $2 billion, $600 million came from one organization in Switzerland.
All right, so this lack of independent audits then that the Clinton Foundation almost fudged to make it look like they did conduct. If they didn't conduct them, as you found, what laws does this violate? Does that violate local law, state law, federal law, charity law? What does that violate?
All right. The principal law that it violates is charity fraud solicitation law. This is a charity that, while we're on this broadcast, is raising money over the internet. It may be using the phones to do it. It may be using the mails. And it's doing this broadly to the public. So when you engage in that type of behavior, your forms, all your filings have to be true and accurate. There's special laws that apply to charities. Charities may not engage in, quote, any illegal activity. So all these forms have to be accurate. They are not accurate. They are raising money. And worse, they are engaged in disaster relief. After the various disasters, 9/11, Katrina, and the frauds that happen, Americans and others are very generous people. We see a disaster, money flows towards a charity. After disasters were exposed starting in 2001, the federal government tightened the sentencing guidelines, the FBI did, for disaster relief charity fraud. And these people are engaged in disaster relief charity fraud. So the penalties for that, and mind you, it's not like Peter Schweitzer's book. You don't have to prove quid pro quo. All you have to show is they are soliciting, which they admit, and that their forms and filings are materially false and misleading, which I believe they are.
So you consider this to be charity fraud then?
Absolutely. It is an epic charity fraud. And what I would say is it's much bigger than $2 billion. Bill Clinton and others around Bill Clinton have been associated with related charities, and they should have been disclosing their related charity involvements. They haven't been. One of them is the American India Foundation. That, I believe, is a $1 billion fraud. There's the operation in Haiti. That's about a $12 to a $13 billion fraud. There's the operation called the Global Fund, which is in the many tens of billions of dollars of fraud involving disgraced convicted felon Rajat Gupta, former head of McKinsey. That's something that started in 2000, I think, two or three. The piece of the Clinton Foundation that Bill takes a lot of credit for, and Hillary and Chelsea, distributing HIV/AIDS medicines around the world, that's a fraud. And there are serious questions about whether the medicines that have been delivered around the world are actually genuine and lawfully produced and effective medicines, or whether they may have been adulterated. And there are very serious questions about this fraud that have been raised by some for years, but only recently, and really in the last 15 months, have I decided to take this kind of effort, because I've done the type a painstaking work. I've approached government authorities last year, several of them, and nothing has happened yet. So I decided, you know, enough is enough. People are being harmed here. The public has a right to know about this, and the public needs to rise up and shut this thing down.
Right. Why not? Why do these government officials ignore this? Because it sounds to me like this is a smoking gun story. This is uncovering an enormous case of charity fraud. It seems to warrant an investigation, if nothing else. Is this a Justice Department matter?
No, you see, for charity fraud, the ways in which charity frauds generally start out getting disciplined at state level, and the states that have the highest income tax rates tend to be, with some exceptions, controlled by Democrats. Even if the states are controlled by Republicans, the regulatory apparatus very frequently is influenced by Democrats. So the state apparatuses so far have not risen up and done their job. The federal IRS, I mean, after all, the IRS chief right now, the House is trying to justifiably impeach him. We know what Lois Lerner did. She ran the department, or it's alleged that she did. She ran the department that oversees charities federally, and foreign governments are shy to take this on because they reason that if the U.S. isn't going to take it on, why should they?
All right. So you said that this is a report in progress, that you have up to 40 reports to make on this. What else do you have? What's more to come?
Well, what I've done, I've actually already on my site, which is www.charlesortel.com. And if you Google me and Clinton Foundation, I've already written extensively about core elements of the fraud. But what I'm doing in these 40 reports is going chronologically, starting from the first moments when this thing operated, October 23rd, 1997, I'm going to take people on a painstakingly detailed journey through the chronology of this charity so that you see what I see. All of this is in the public domain. I'm mindful of the fact that many Americans and many people, even detail-oriented people, don't have the patience to go through hundreds and hundreds of pages of tables and charts and footnotes and links and things like that. So that's why I chopped it into 40 more easily digestible bites. I'm going to begin the first exhibit shortly. Is just simply going to deal with the early years when Bill was still president of the United States, when he still effectively controlled the executive branch, and show you the early years and where the frauds actually started. Because this thing, which was supposed to be, in my view, or said it was going to be a library, immediately was used, again, in my view, as a political fundraising machine to pay off Bill and Hillary's legal bills and also to set Hillary up for her Senate seat. That's what we're going to cover in the first exhibit.
All right. And for those of us, like you said, those of us, me and my viewers, who may not be able to go through all the painstaking details of the last 15 months that you have, can you give us any hints of what's more to come? Anything that the media and American people, even those who aren't necessarily interested in politics, are going to stop? They're going to say, wow, that is incredible. We can't elect this woman to be president, and this warrants investigation because it is outrageous.
Well, I would say that the last time that Hillary ran for president in 2007 and 8 was one example of a very egregious episode where over $100 million was diverted from the Clinton Foundation in that period from monies that this Geneva-based organization sent towards the Clinton Foundation in that period. And on its books, which are publicly available, on Unitaid's public books, it clearly shows that they sent about $100 million more towards the Clinton Foundation than the Clinton Foundation claims it received. In that period, major Democrat Party figures were on the board, and they didn't do their work. Another thing that might shock people is that Bill Clinton himself, though he has talked endlessly about this being his foundation, was not a named trustee or executive of any part of the foundation until December 31st, 2009, and not a trustee of the main one until sometime in 2013. Nevertheless, in September 2007, he published a book called Giving, in which he brags about all of his work, calls it his foundation extensively, yet doesn't point out to the public that he earned more than $6 million writing that book about charity and pocketed about $5 million for himself. That is something that absolutely had to be disclosed in the books,
right,
and is twice as big an affront to those of us who care about charities as what was in the Wall Street Journal last week.
Right. That is unbelievable. Charles, I hope you'll come back. Keep us updated on this story as it unfolds, because it sounds like you've got some good stuff to come. Good work on this. And also,
all right. So I was floored. So according, and I did some research on this guy. There's just a couple of articles that I see here. Harvard MBA guy is out to bring down the Clintons. He's got his website, Charles Ortel, O-R-T-E-L. Clinton Foundation has got its own link there. So, all right. So, okay. So Bill Clinton starts this foundation, but he's not officially involved with it until 8 or 9 years after he leaves office. That's amazing to me. And it is taken in billions of dollars. So according to this guy, if the charity is brought in, Clinton Foundation has brought in $2 billion on the books, according to this guy, it's brought in a lot more than that. So Bill Clinton is effectively, you know, everybody knows that when he got out of office, he started giving speeches and stuff, and he made something like $150 million, whatever it was, $120 million, which became his, you know, his net worth from giving speeches and stuff, being on boards and that type of thing. But Clinton is effectively a billionaire. If what this guy is saying is true, Clinton is effectively a billionaire. He's riding around, you know, he's the head of this billion-dollar organization, multi-billion-dollar organization, and they're spending money, according to this guy, like drunken sailors. 10% of the money is going into the charitable aspect and everything else, 90% of the rest of it is going to supporting the organization. That's stunning. And so my question, I have a couple of questions. What about all the good work that they claim that the foundation has done? First of all, you know, dealing with disease in Africa and disaster relief in Haiti and all that. First off, and then second off, what about why hasn't this come up? Why hasn't this been reported on? I mean, this thing has been going on for, I mean, he's been out of office, and then you've got George Bush for 2 years or two terms. Then you've got Barack Obama for two terms. So we're talking like 15 years later. And why isn't it popular knowledge that if this is true, it's like nobody's done so this would tend to buy into or support the narrative that the media is leftist leaning and doesn't want to report. I mean, to this day, we still don't know what grades Obama got in school, for example. If it was George Bush, I think that you would have found out on the third day of his presidency. So anyway, that is why people believe that's why people come to talk radio, because we can talk about anything here and we can move with whatever story is coming out. And, you know, the news doesn't have to be shaved down or formed and purified like a Twinkie. I guess Twinkies have become bimbo cakes, but which would be appropriate. But all right, so here's some headlines for you. Trump, who's paying for Obama Clinton political trips? And that's Obama Hillary Clinton. The president is now campaigning for Hillary. Do you think that's appropriate or inappropriate, or do you think it matters? Hillary's State Department record delays mounting up. Comey will address reporters at 11 a.m. Eastern time today at FBI headquarters. So what would he be talking about? All right. So here are some of the names of the vice president for Trump that have been circulated. Chris Christie, Bob Corker, Joni Ernst. Joni Ernst is a Tea Party lady out of the middle of the country. Newt Gingrich, Mike Pence, Jeff Sessions. And so they're saying that Trump definitely needs somebody with a lot of political connections. So obviously, since he's from outside of the process. All right. So in terms of final primary analysis of all of these states that voted, Republican turnout is up by 62%. Democrat participation is down 21%. That's getting near 100%. That's a 83% differential between the Republicans last time and the Democrats. They're talking about ISIS moving across European borders with ease, which has been one of the reasons that England left the EU. Now, here I have got something to play for you out of history. I think you'll remember this little clip here. Sorry about the zany music.
And you know we can't just drill our way to lower gas prices.
You know that we can't just drill our way to lower gas prices. You know, we can't just drill our way to lower gas prices. As much as we're doing to increase oil production, we're not going to be able to just drill our way out of the problem of high gas prices. Anybody who tells you otherwise either doesn't know what they're talking about or they aren't telling you the truth.
All right, so I've got some breaking news for you, which came out over the weekend. U.S. oil reserves surpassed those of Saudi Arabia and Russia. So, and how did that happen? We drilled and we fracked our way out of it. So we've got this it's absolutely amazing that, you know, if somebody would tell you that while the president was giving these speeches about not being able to drill your way out, that we were actually drilling our way out. Not just that, that we would become the number one. It's amazing. So, I mean, I think Venezuela's got more, but Venezuela has tremendous problems, as we've reported here before. So, got a lot more good stories in the next round. I hope you listened yesterday, because we covered a lot of ground on the history of the country, and I learned a lot just listening in myself. All right, I'll take you out with a little Horace Silver songs for my father. Song for my father. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450 to call in, and 805-6180 for your text line. We'll see you after the break on the hour. Okay, so we had over this last week a surprising number of attacks from ISIS, and one of the things that really stood out, and you know, who knows exactly what it means, but in the attack in Bangladesh, all of the attackers appear to have been upper class boys, and so or young men going to you know, middle class, upper middle class, upper class scions of their families, and they were persuaded to become radicalized. And so scary in that if you get that kind of support from ISIS in other countries in the Middle East, then I don't see how you would stop ISIS. If it became that popular, then it would infiltrate the military and the leadership of these governments. And maybe it already has. I mean, to what extent there is government support for this stuff. But before we get to talk about that, I've got a little bit of weather for you. There is Hurricane Blas, Tropical Storm Agatha, and Hurricane Blas on the left side of Mexico instead of the Gulf. And so we could be affected by this. And this is from the Weather Channel.
Remember last year, the Pacific was very strong. This year, it really shouldn't be going into a neutral and then eventually La Nina phase. But what it should be and what's actually happening are two different things. Tropical Storm Agatha, we're not going to even show you this on satellite because it looks awful. Winds 30 miles an hour by tomorrow morning. It will be gone by Wednesday. Even though it's going in the general direction of Hawaii, no concerns there. Now, Hurricane Blas was just upgraded here. Winds at 75 miles an hour. This looks pretty good. It is expected to become a major hurricane, but it will track into cooler waters eventually.
Okay, so that is, I guess, good news for Mexico, which has had some devastating storms the last couple of years. Now, severe thunderstorms returning to the plains, Midwest, and Great Lakes this week.
Haven't been confirmed yet, but that certainly does look like a tornado that moved through Louisa, Kentucky on Monday. Now, this one system caused about 100 trees to go down and many power lines. It was certainly a wild day of severe weather there on Monday. And today, that threat moves up to the north. So we're talking the northern plains will have the risk for severe showers, thunderstorms to move through by late afternoon into the evening. Now, can't rule out possible tornadoes. The highest threat, that's going to be through the northern plains by later today. So you can see those cells start to fire up. Isolated tornadoes will be the threat, and this is going to continue through midweek. So on Wednesday, still looking at the threat of severe weather through South Dakota, Nebraska, and even down through Kansas.
All right. Now, here is a little bit on the heat advisory that is really very close to us, and I don't need to tell you that. Dangerous heat all throughout Texas and into Louisiana, Oklahoma, and somewhat into New Mexico.
Super duper duper.
Oh, yeah,
hot.
Look at that. Whoa.
Heat advisory is almost the entire state of Texas.
Yeah, upper ridging in place. That's keeping the jet stream to the north. So the thunderstorm chances that far south in Texas, Red River Valley itself, pretty small chance
of
storms.
Yeah, they're not going to get. Yeah, that's true. But you know what I always think about? Like, Texas is known for their heat. So if they're going to put out a heat advisory, you know it's going to be exceptionally hot.
Yeah, and it's also – sometimes people think Texas is also dry. It's not. It can get very humid.
Oh,
dew
so
points
humid.
Widespread in the 70s with temps right around 100 gives you these heat indices.
Yeah, so your heat index is going to be above 100 anywhere from El Paso to Brownsville. Even if you go into the water, again, like the water's not going to evaporate from your skin because it's so humid out. And so it cools you off like for a second. That's it.
All right, and there is one, let's see here, I've got a couple more clips for you, weather related, one of which is kind of an interesting one on, well, let me play the hurricane prediction for 2016 Atlantic.
It's hurricane season. We've already had some weather notables for the year. We want you to take a look again at the hurricane forecast because it's been updated to reflect the... So the weather company and IBM Business has actually increased the forecast by one in each category. This is a look. The first thing we're showing you is actually the average, followed by the CSU forecast, which stands for Colorado State University. There's NOAA's forecast. And then there is the weather company's forecast, showing you a total of 15 named storms, 9 hurricanes, and 4 of those being major hurricanes. As we mentioned, CSU also increasing its hurricane forecast just a little bit. This is prepared by Dr. Phil Klotzbach. He is an amazing guy. He believes that we will see a near-average season thanks to a weak La Nina and cooler-than-normal sea surface temperatures in the far North Atlantic. And then, of course, there's NOAA, which also issued its forecast there at the end of May. Keep in mind, again, all three of these outlooks have included Hurricane Alex and the three tropical storms that have already formed so far, Bonnie, Colin, and Danielle.
All right, and this last one is on new Arctic greening in Canada, so it could portend climate change of some kind, although I am not, of course, giving in to global warming.
Says vegetation growth in Canada's Arctic is expanding at a rapid rate. They say the reason is clear. It's due to climate change. Scientists looked at 3 decades of satellite images. What they found were grassy tundras changing to shrublands and bushes growing even bigger and denser than before. In addition, temperatures are warming in the Arctic faster than elsewhere. Researchers found that 30% of the 4 million square miles in Canada greened up, while just 3% showed a vegetation decline.
All right, so how about the idea that we've got climate change, but it is not created by carbon, that there's some other factor? And I think that's one of the problems when science, everybody in science jumps on one idea, and you're not allowing anybody who disagrees with, you know, global warming as caused by human beings is immediately driven out of the academy if they can possibly do that. Why not allow people to work on their own ideas, and hopefully one of which will turn out to be accurate in the future? Horace Silver, listening this week to Song for My Father, one of the great jazz albums of all time. 7:13 a.m. Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. 523-1450 to call in, 805-61802 text. And it's going to be pretty warm. It's in the mid-70s right now. We'll be right back. I've got a hilarious New Mexico story here for you from PennLive.com. Fear and loathing in Las Cruces, Pennsylvania. Trump supporter sets off New Mexico firestorm with letter. But first, we have a phone call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Kelly, it's Ralph.
Ralph,
your worst toothache. Kelly, you're almost betting 1,000. Your programs here for the last month have really been great.
Oh, I thought I thought you were going to say I had a mistake every day. Well, I appreciate it, man.
Kelly, see that idiot from the Las Cruces Sun News off the air. Holy smokes, what an improvement. That's what got me to call Tuesday, and you don't have him on there yet.
I miss Walt. But he got mad and left. Hey, Walt's free to call anytime. I've just been so busy. I'm sure we'll have him back on the show. What a great guy, Walt Rubel, huh? Fear and loathing in Las Cruces, Pennsylvania. Trump supporter sets off New Mexico firestorm with letter. I'm just going to try to get some of the highlights out of this. An Oil City, Pennsylvania man has touched off a firestorm 1,600 miles away from home after sending a letter to the largest newspaper in New Mexico warning of a fringe element. Quote, radical feminists, angry Indians, and illegal Mexicans, as he put it, threatening to scare off tourists like him in the future. Now, this is William Strong, a conservative and Donald Trump supporter. He wrote in a letter sent to the Albuquerque Journal earlier this month. And maybe I'll just go to the letter and see what they've got. This stupid thing you have to go through in the Albuquerque Journal. You have to answer a question and everything. Oh, boy. Oh, come on. All right, so that's not going to happen. I can't answer a 27-page questionnaire to get into the paper. We'll just have to wing it from this. All right, so William Strong writes, my wife and I, in a letter to the editor of the Albuquerque Journal, my wife and I are retired in Pennsylvania and just finished a 10-day tour of New Mexico. He called New Mexico's landscape enchanting, but says, quote, the same cannot be said about a significant portion of people in New Mexico. Who does this guy think he is? All right. Strong claims he was, quote, verbally attacked twice by liberals in Santa Fe. Well, I mean, that would be a good place to get attacked by liberals. And he said, quote, because we are Christian conservatives and hold a different political point of view. And then he added, quote, we were forced to keep our mouths shut for fear of physical reprisals. In Taos, we both got a massage. I told the masseuse about our encounters in Santa Fe and that we would support Trump. Her exact words to me were to keep your mouth shut because we would be physically attacked. How true her words were. Strong says he and his wife left New Mexico the night after fiery protests at a Donald Trump rally in Albuquerque. Quote, we didn't attend the rally, but we were scared. What a disgrace to such a beautiful state. And so there was a fiery reaction in the newspaper. Many New Mexicans taking pride in his criticisms and others simply mocking it. Oh, my stars. This sounds like Frankie. Oh, my stars. Clutching their pearl necklaces all the way from Pennsylvania. How brave of them to visit New Mexico, said a tweeter who goes by the handle ALDog87. And Noah Boswell, another commenter, said, quote, this makes me wicked proud to be New Mexican. Middle fingers up. While the third one, Ray Leggins, wrote to Strong in the comment section of Albuquerque Journal, quote, don't F and make sure to spread your story far and wide among others of your ilk. We don't want you polluting our magical state. Strong, meanwhile, told the New Mexican, he's only trying to speak to the good people of New Mexico. And he says, quote, hey, this radical fringe here, you need to crack down on them because they are scaring your tourists, not making your wonderful, beautiful state what it should be. I mean, he may have a point, my friends. Why do I say that? Because we're losing out on gas and oil. We got to fall back on something. Long considered a swing state, New Mexico increasingly is considered to be blue. And in 2010, New Mexico was 46% Hispanic, 10% Native. And, and here's a great point. The political shift has also been attributed to the Republican Party's failure to court a majority of those voters. The GOP doesn't even try. The GOP is like, you know, one of those like calcified fetuses, you know, has no actual life. 37 Republicans and 37 Republicans and 33 Democrats in the House of Representatives for 2015, 24 Democrats, 18 Republicans in the Senate. We got to get that Senate back, conservatives. And 46% of New Mexico voters are registered Democrats, 31% is Republicans, 19% failed to give a preference or they couldn't read it, and 3% have chosen other affiliations. All right, so isn't that amazing? Isn't that an amazing story? Doesn't that make you proud to be a New Mexican, that you were running off all these ugly conservatives? Wow, I have a fishing report here, but I don't think we're quite that bored. But this is from Santa Fe, New Mexico. It covers every conceivable body of water except what you can find in your bathroom. Let's see, though. Going to go down, see if we can find Elephant Butte here. Let's see. All right, southeast. It doesn't even mention okay, here we go. Fair enough. Speaking of not being able to read, Elephant Butte Lake, fishing was fair to good using minnows, curly tail grubs, topwater lures, and crankbaits for white bass. Fishing was fair using topwater lures, jerkbaits, salt craws, tubes, worms, and senkos for smallmouth bass and largemouth bass. Night fishing was good using shad, liver, fat bait, and shrimp for catfish. Fishing was fair using minnows, curly tail, grubs, and small jigs for crappie and walleye. Well, it sounds like there is some actual fish in Elephant Butte, which is a relief after it got so low. Oh, and Ruidoso River, fair using salmon eggs and worms for trout. That's nice. All right. Okay. 29 New Mexico charter schools have filed a complaint against the current director of the Options for Parent Division, commonly referred to as the Charter Schools Division of Public Education, and the New Mexico Coalition in a letter for charters, New Mexico Coalition for Charter Schools in a letter dated May 3rd outlined 20 complaints against the CSD and Director Katie Poulos, and the letter was sent to Public Education Commission. And some people didn't sign for fear of reprisals. Two Las Cruces charter schools signed the letter, New America School, Las Cruces, and La Academia Dolores Huerta. And this is in the Albuquerque Journal, by the way. And so what are the complaints? Well, I tell you what, let me take a break here. I want to just read it here. Let me read it and sum it up, and then we'll move on. 727 flying those friendly skies. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. Kelly O'Connell, 523 1450 805 61802. Text. And don't forget to insult a conservative today, especially if they're from out of state. We'll be right back. All right, so we're looking at this article, New Mexico Charter Schools File Complaint Against State, and this is actually came from down here, was published in the Sun News, so was picked up by the Albuquerque Journal. There was a letter that was written on behalf of 29 New Mexico schools. 20 signed the letter, 7 lodged complaints, but elected not to add their names for fear of revenge. And here's just a little bit of what it points out on the charter schools. Charter schools are public schools which operate independent of public school system. They are operated either by nonprofit or for-profit organizations. Although largely publicly funded, charter schools are exempt from many requirements imposed by state and local boards of education regarding hiring and curriculum. Charter schools can be either affiliated with an existing school district or can operate under a state charter granted by the PEC. All of the charter schools in Las Cruces are state chartered. None are chartered through Las Cruces Public Schools. And as public schools, charter schools cannot charge tuition or impose special entrance requirements. Students are usually admitted through a lottery process if demand exceeds the number of spaces available. All right. So here is what this letter said. The relationship between the CSD and charter schools appears to have deteriorated significantly over the past year, and in numerous cases, it appears broken. The current CSD director is micromanaging oversight rather than evaluating outcomes and looking for ways to assist charters. And the CSD is not entitled to do whatever it wants or act however it wants or ignore PEC directives, policies, and procedures with respect to the PEC's charter school simply because it is a division of the New Mexico Public Education Department. And they listed 50 examples and an overall general atmosphere of hostility between CSD and state charters. And that they claim that Ms. Polos has an arrogant and controlling attitude. And so the schools are very afraid of retaliation. And the letter goes on. My concern is the dysfunctional relationship between Ms. Polos and the PEC and Ms. Polos and the school, said Mark Hartshorn. Oh, okay. Statement by Mark Hartshorn, principal of Alma Day Art Charter School High School, Las Cruces. So, anyway, who knows how this will turn out, but there is some dissatisfaction there. I've got another story for you. New Mexico ranchers and U.S. Forest Service clash over water restrictions. And Steve Pierce and State Representative Jim Townsend met with the Forest Service representatives in Cloudcroft with ranchers present to talk about water access and its impact on the economy. And both are supporting ranchers in an ongoing dispute over water restrictions. And Townsend said the issue had reached a tipping point, should have said a boiling point, you know, so we're talking about water, with recent closures of portions of Lincoln National Forest to protect the habitat of the endangered New Mexico meadow jumping mouse. U.S. Forest Service had repeatedly defended its actions, saying it has responsibilities under the Endangered Species Act, but agency officials say they will try to compromise. Well, that's a nice breakthrough. And Terry McMillan, Dr. McMillan from Las Cruces, is putting in a bill, that House Bill 270, that would protect Texas doctors because a patient from New Mexico took a Texas Tech surgeon in Lubbock, Texas, to court in New Mexico. And McMillan said this was his inspiration, that if we didn't do something about this, Texas doctors would have to stop seeing New Mexico patients. And McMillan said 25% of hospitalizations of people from Dona Ana County happened in the Lone Star State. And McMillan's House Bill 270 became law on Friday. It's meant to protect these Texas doctors and hospitals. And for the next 3 years, patients who go to a Texas physician or institution will probably be asked to sign a waiver, says McMillan. So so McMillan is concerned that the malpractice issues for these people will cause there to be a lack of receptivity from doctors in Texas. Anyway, 7:35. We'll take a little break here and come back and talk about ISIS. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. 800-523-1450 and 805-6180. It's insult a conservative tourist day, by the way. Okay, so we had attacks that occurred in the last few weeks all over the place, and it's really crazy that it seems like ISIS is trying to say that they can attack anywhere at any time, that they've got people all across the world that are willing to attack. Now, I was saying about the Bangladesh attack, it was normal kids, it was not radicals, it was the sons of upper class and middle class people that carried out these attacks, which is kind of scary to me because it means that this movement has really infiltrated across the society. And if it can happen in Bangladesh, it could happen anywhere in terms of that pull for those groups of people.
On the Dhaka attack is Mia Bloom, professor of communications at Georgia State University. Thank you so much for being with us. The whole
CNN
world, in fact, is watching Bangladesh now to see how they respond to this terrorist attack. What's your expectation of how they're going to respond?
Well, in the past, when there was an Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist attack, there was 500 different bombs that went off in 2005.
I am not hearing this over the transom. So here is a little bit more from CNN. TAC 200 killed in Baghdad.
Massive and horrifying. At least 215 people killed in a suicide bombing that...
I'm not hearing this either, so let me reload here. Here's PBS talking about defeated on the battlefield, ISIS steps up terror attack.
We take a closer look at the increase in attacks by ISIS around the globe with two reporters who've covered the insurgency very closely. Joby Warwick covers national security for the Washington Post. His book, Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. It was his second Pulitzer. And Rukmini Kalamaki is a correspondent with the New York Times and joins us from Paris. Welcome to you both. Rukmini, I'd like to start with you. This spasm of violence that we've seen over the past week, three attacks, three countries, what do you make of this? Are they sending a message? Is this a coincidence? Were they planning it this way?
ISIS, like all jihadi groups, considers Ramadan to be a sacred time for doing jihad. And before the start of the holy month of Ramadan, which began roughly 3 weeks ago, the spokesman of the group issued once again a call for an increase in violence. And so the way I read it is that these attacks and the heightening of them in this period is a response to that call.
And Joby, how do they do this? How do they get these attacks going? Some of them, are they directed by ISIS? Are they just inspired by ISIS?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. And as Rukmini said, they've been issuing the call to do something during Ramadan. And the call specifically says, whatever is available to you, if you don't wait for orders, don't wait for instructions, you have an opportunity to do something nasty, do it. And so you've seen a lot of lone wolf attacks. You've seen some gangs getting together and doing some of these attacks. It's not necessarily coordinated, but it's very effective.
And Rukmini, were these attacks in any way, you say that they sent the word out that they wanted this to happen, but is just that the opportunities came up in this cluster?
If you are an adherent to this group, you know the rhythm, and you know that Ramadan is a period when these attacks, almost like a prayer, are supposed to be viewed as more holy than at other times of the year. And so I think it's reasonable to expect that the attacks we've seen have been in the planning stages for some time, and that they use Ramadan as a time to hit. And adding to what Joby said, we've seen in this period of Ramadan both inspired attacks. So we had Omar Mateen in Orlando, Florida, and we had a guy called Larossi Abola here in France who stabbed to death a policeman in the name of ISIS. We saw attacks that they directed themselves, and carried out themselves, like Baghdad yesterday. And then we've seen attacks like Bangladesh, which are being carried out basically by their territories abroad. Bangladesh has been one of their territories that they have spent a lot of time hyping in their publication. And the attack in the cafe that happened a few days ago was the 19th attack in Bangladesh claimed by ISIS in less than 9 months.
Is there a danger, Joby, that there's going to be a backlash? I mean, the Turkey attack, Turkey has never really taken a lot of action against ISIS. Is this going to trigger a big response from Turkey?
The Turks are certainly indicating that it will. They've been trying to crack down on recruits, for example, and weapons going across the border. But now it's obviously a full-scale war. So you have to be seen what they'll do that's different from what they're doing now, perhaps some more shared resources, allowing others to use their soil for attacks against the caliphate. But I think that the Turks are really in the game now. So that sense, there is blowback. There will be a price exacted with ISIS for doing these kinds of attacks. And you'll see it in other places too, such as Bangladesh. The whole world really is rallying in a way that is unprecedented against this organization.
And Rukmini, a lot's been made about the fact that the attacks in Turkey and in Bangladesh were carried out by groups rather than individuals, that it was sort of coordination among these people.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something new? Is this a sort of a new development, taking this to a next?
Not really. I mean, you have to look back to the November 13th attack in Paris, which was carried out by 10 ISIS attackers, 9 of whom traveled from Syria to carry out those killings. The Brussels attacks were a mixed bag. It included people that had traveled from Syria and then locals that they joined up with there. Turkey, we're still in that fog where we don't exactly know how these people enter Turkey. Did they come from Syria? Did they come from somewhere else? But the indication has been that they were most likely sent by ISIS Central. And then Bangladesh, you have a growing network that I think has gone unnoticed, because until a couple of days ago, they hadn't had a catastrophic attack like we've seen now. But if you're watching their publication and their propaganda, Bangladesh was very much a place that was in their crosshairs. They've been very much amping up their rhetoric there.
And Jovi, this also comes as they've been losing territory. They've been losing ground in Iraq, in Syria. They just lost Fallujah this past week. Is this in any sense ISIS saying it doesn't matter, they're trying to project their force outside that territory in a way?
It is interesting that the weaker they get in their caliphate and their home territory, more they do seem to lash out. And whether this is really, you know, them just trying to still be relevant, or if it's something that suggests that they're really moving to a new phase, that's something to be seen. Because even though they're losing territory, they're losing personnel in the caliphate, they're growing their organization in other places. We see these other, inspired groups, we see cells, we see reorganized, ISIS organizations in other places. And some of those are getting bigger instead of smaller. So this campaign's not over by any stretch.
Joby Warwick, Rukmini Callimachi, that's a very sobering note to end on. Thanks for being with us.
All right, so I'm looking up here the countries that have been attacked and by ISIS. And here is, I'm looking at, and I think this is, let's see what site this is from, Daily Mail UK. Areas with ISIS territory includes basically the entire top of Africa: Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Mali, Morocco, and then to the right, Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And then in Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, obviously. So that's a large number of places where ISIS has territory. And if you were to look at it, I mean, that would be the area that, I'm not, of course, the claim isn't that they've taken all of this area, but where they're at, if you put all that land together, I'm sure it would be as big as the lower 48 of the United States. Territory, or they formed alliances in these places. So so there have been targeted attacks from January 15 by ISIS Paris, the Yemen mosque bombing, Tunisia, Turkey, Egypt, Paris, California, Brussels, And now you've got to add on to that Turkey, this latest bombing in Turkey and Bangladesh and Saudi Arabia. Now, that was, to me, one of the most interesting things, because Saudi Arabia is holy. The entire state is holy to Islam, because that is the land of the Prophet, and Mecca and Medina are the holiest of holy cities. And so why would these radicals go after bombing there? It's to send a message. It's to kill foreigners, obviously, who are not supposed to be in, you know, in this land. And it would be to punish the government for having a relationship for places like United States. So we'll take a break here and finish up. 7:48 a.m. Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 and 805-6180. Certainly we have not seen the end of ISIS bombings. All right, the last topic I want to bring up with you, Obama, globalization is here and done. Question, and I guess this is the show's ending in a few minutes, so it's a question to kind of consider, maybe discuss tomorrow. Why is Obama so completely dedicated and married to globalization in such a way that he would fly to another country to tell them how they should vote in terms of being part of a regional government in their area? Which certainly seems like it would be outside of the, it's a busy body maneuver, number one. Number two, would the founding fathers have appreciated Obama flying to London to give a speech on how England needed to stay in the EU? So Obama says integration of national economies into a global economy, that's here, that's done. And, so Obama blames economic problems on people who are struggling economically have a legitimate gripe with globalization. That's what he blames. I believe the bad economy here, because there's something came out today that said, or maybe last night, that stated that the coming months and years are going to be very difficult for America financially or economically. So Obama said attacking Trump, he's campaigning for Hillary, he's giving her his blessings. Now, how this guy gets the highest marks, the highest support of his time in office now, I don't understand it. But it could be nostalgia kicking in, a premature nostalgia. But what is it about globalization that this guy likes? Okay, if you're like me and you've often scratched your head at decisions by Obama and said, what is this guy, why does he do this? What would be gained by having a country and allowing the border to be porous and encouraging and rewarding even people who came across the border illegally and moving them around the country? I mean, you could say, well, we're underpopulated, we need more population, but I don't think anybody believes that's the reason. It's not because most of these people have skills that America needs in terms of higher education and training. So there's got to be another reason. And my understanding of Obama is that this globalism that he's bought into, that he's fighting for passionately, it represents some type of world. I hate to use the term socialism, Marxism, because those terms are so heavily laden with emotion and everything. But I think that you've got to remember that Obama comes out of a very, very leftist family. And so everybody who was an authority figure to this guy, his mom, his dad, his grandparents, his stepfather, I mean, all of these people, this guy Davis that trained him, all of these people were either socialists were Marxists or communists. And so he grew up in that environment. That was his reality. And I think that, you know, you have to give the president the benefit of the doubt in terms of whether he wants to make the world a better place. I believe that he does. I just disagree with how he wants to do it. History has already tested socialism and found out that it doesn't work. But there's a part also, and which makes very weird to me, the enthusiasm for people. And there's a part of socialism that has to buy into tyranny. And so according to Marx, who's probably the most influential writer on the topic, you've got socialism that turns into communism. And then it's supposed to, and this is what all these people are supposedly looking for, into this benign anarchy. And during the time that socialism is turning into communism, it's got something called the tyranny of the proletariat. The tyranny, basically, and then there's the vanguard of the proletariat. These are the elites. And so Obama is in this group, and Hillary is in this group, and Bill Clinton is in this group, and all of these people that make decisions that seem to be at times anti-American or against our interests, you could, I don't claim to know the motivation of all these people, but I do not understand why Hillary Clinton would support, for example, allowing an uprising to occur in Libya when only the worst forces are going to gain power. And so she supports 100%, it's supposedly even her idea, Muslim Spring applied to Libya. So you've got Muammar Gaddafi, who's a kind of a reformed terrorist who's now working with the West. He started building a nuclear mountain to build a nuclear weapon. And when George Bush attacked in his original attack over there, Gaddafi got very scared and he communicated with the West and he admitted he had all this stuff in this mountain. And then he became, he turned into a friend of the West and he became a gatekeeper in Africa, with something we desperately need right now. And he was also selling more oil to the Europe than anybody else. Now, Hillary decides that she's going to support overthrowing this guy, and what's been the result? ISIS now has a stronger foothold in Libya than any other place. It is a country run by rebels, various factions of Islamic radicals. The country is in chaos, and there have been a lot of people killed because of this one decision. Now, that decision was applied across the Middle East. But why would you support a radical overthrow of the government, knowing that the country that was there is undoubtedly going to be better than the country that is going to take its place? And I would say these people all believe in an internationalism that's coming. You can call it the New World Order. You can call it United Nations applying its authority in every sphere. You could call it anything you want, but they clearly believe, and this is a tenet of the socialist view of the world. World bodies need to control things so the world is not driven and controlled by profiteers, that it's just not greedy capitalists that are trying to run everything. They believe they will bring world peace when material goods are no longer the source of friction and war. And they believe they're bringing in this new order. And that's what I understand the president to be committed to. Show me a better explanation and I'll accept it. Until then, that's what I'm buying into. 7:59, thanks for listening in AM Las Cruces. Enjoyed hanging out with you, 1450 KOBE, and we'll catch up in 22 hours. We'll take you up with some Horace Silver, Song for My Father, Child.